Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. In this episode, we'll be hearing from obesity medicine specialist and OMA clinical education director, Dr. Nicholas Pennies. He'll be interviewing Dr. John Batsis. Dr. Batsis is an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Geriatric Medicine at the UNC School of Medicine and the Department of Nutrition in the Gilling School of Public Health. Dr. Batsis was a presenter at the 2021 OMA Fall Obesity Summit. Today, our speakers discuss improving health in older patients with obesity. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medical Association, a clinical leader in obesity medicine.
Baby boomers are aging. By 2029, the last of the baby boomer group will turn 65. At that time, over 60 million boomers will enter the ranks of the geriatric population. With the population of seniors rising, obesity rates rising, and with adiposity-related diseases like cancer, heart disease, and diabetes increasing with age, are we setting up for a perfect storm? Obesity rates in the geriatric population are similar to the general population, which translates to over 40 million senior Americans with overweight or obesity. Unfortunately, the data on the treatment of obesity in the geriatric population is limited. This is important to know because seniors with obesity have some unique characteristics requiring special considerations when managing weight. Hi, I'm Dr. Nick Pennings, Chair of Family Medicine at the Campbell University School of Osteopathic Medicine and OMA Clinical Education Director. And with me today is John Batsis, MD. Dr. Batsis is an Associate Professor of Medicine in the Division of Geriatric Medicine at UNC School of Medicine and the Department of Nutrition in the Gilling School of Global Public Health. He has a special interest in obesity in the geriatric population and presented at the 2021 OMA Fall Obesity Summit. His presentation was titled Improving Health and Function in the Older Patient with Obesity. Welcome, Dr. Batsis.
Hi, Dr. Pennings. Very nice to be part of today's podcast.
Thank you for being here. So I wanted to start off by asking you about BMI. It's a standard metric for assessing obesity, but it has some unique challenges in the elderly population. What do you see as some of the strengths and limitations of utilizing BMI in assessing weight status in geriatrics?
So BMI is a really interesting anthropometric marker, which is used ubiquitously, really, in clinical practice. It's weight in kilograms divided by height in meters squared. And it really, it's been developed based on life tables years ago. And it's been now being used as a marker for obesity and overweight. And we're using this to classify individuals in these categories. Now, as one ages, we know that there are changes in body composition. And unfortunately, body mass index, or BMI, doesn't account for all these changes. As one ages, you tend to end up getting increase in amount of body fat with age, particularly centrally, termed visceral adiposity or central adiposity. But importantly, one loses muscle mass as one ages. And this is termed sarcopenia, loss of muscle mass and strength with aging. So why is that important? Because body mass index really doesn't account for these two entities, and hence it becomes an inaccurate marker with poor sensitivity as one ages. In addition, as one ages, one's height changes. And this is seen often as one's vertebrae start collapsing. Osteoporosis affects one's spine. So one's height diminishes with age. And this will affect your body mass index ratio.
And so then as someone ages, their weight may stay the same, but their body composition is changing, and that may create more of a metabolic profile of obesity, even though their weight hasn't changed. They may shift into that.
And a lot of that has to do with using BMI, or body mass index, to measure that. So a body mass index of, say, 30 or even, say, 28 in a 65 or an 85-year-old may be different as compared to someone in their 30s. You have different degrees of body composition at these different age categories.
Right. And also their height goes down. And I know when you use self-reported height, most people will use their tallest height to never really account for that decline with aging.
Yeah. And that's always a tough one. The self-reported versus objective measurements, because folks end up tend to underreport weight and overestimate height. And hence your BMI actually is likely under the value that what it really should be.
So with obesity, we see health risks at any age. However, when patients start to reach around 70s or 80s, the impact of higher BMI on all-cause mortality seems to diminish. So is this because with those with greater amounts of adiposity and metabolic disease are dying at an earlier age, maybe self-selection process here, or those with less weight-related metabolic changes are surviving longer? Or is there some particular health benefit to having a higher weight in your 70s?
And that's always a million-dollar question, Nick, you know, in terms of when is it too early or too late to start or stop recommending treatment in this population? You're absolutely right. When you look at BMI curves, they actually flatten with mortality with age. But again, you need to be mindful of the changes in body composition. So when you look at waist circumference, those curves aren't as flat as they are in a younger population. In addition, one of the challenges has to do with where the fat is. And again, BMI doesn't account for that. If it's more centrally, that's a problem. It leads to a lot more inflammation and a lot more disease. I think to your question about is there self-selection is a really good one. And that's one of the challenges with a lot of epidemiological data that really demonstrate, is there an evidence of that these individuals are dying earlier? There are a lot of methodological issues in a number of these older cohort studies that need to be accounted for and weren't accounted for. And there are advanced methods, statistical methods that can now integrate that. So the jury's still a little bit out as to, is there a self-selection? And particularly nowadays, in the year 2021, medical care is much different than what it was even 20 or 30 years ago.
So you mentioned that the curve is sort of flattening. Is that because the higher risk is moving down in the higher weights? Or is it because those that are more of a normal weight because of changes in body composition are moving up?
Great question. And, you know, there is a great systematic review and meta-analysis that was conducted a couple of years ago that actually amassed over 197,000 older adults. And when you look at that curve, the inflection point at where mortality starts rising is that actually a BMI, body mass index of 33, not 30, not 25, 33. And the lowest mortality was actually a body mass index of 27. So in some ways, there's a shift in that curve. The other important factor in a number of these studies is that the number of patients that are included is not as high as some of the other studies that have a larger cohort of patients. And a lot of it has to do with statistical adjustment. You need to make sure you're adjusting for the right measures. And there have been a number of folks in the epidemiology world that noted that you have individuals that are ill, they die of cancer, for instance, and their weight just drops. So the differentiation of intentional and unintentional weight loss is often not incorporated in these analyses either. And it's difficult unless you're doing a formal clinical trial.
Okay. So cognitive function is always a concern with aging as well. What role does obesity play in cognitive functions as people age?
So cognition and Alzheimer's disease and related dementias is by far one of the major elements that I see as a primary care geriatrician in my practice. And that's the fear that individuals who have intact function, they don't want to develop. So what can we do? We know from a lot of the earlier epi work that midlife obesity increases one's risk of cognitive impairment. We know that being physically inactive, having poor dietary quality also impact. We know from an intervention standpoint that physical activity is probably the best way to reduce one's risk, genetics aside, and being able to aggressively manage your hypertension, your diabetes, your high cholesterol. So patients with obesity who are in the older adult range over the age of 65, don't fret, don't worry. There is an ability to work on some of these health promotion endeavors, the hope of improving and maintaining cognitive function downstream. What's really important, though, is that there are a number of dietary interventions and physical activity interventions separately that have demonstrated either maintenance or preservation of cognitive function. Multi-component interventions, there's a lack of a solid randomized control trial evidence for that.
So when we think about all the comorbidities associated with aging and obesity, one of the concerns is that as patients age, they often also, even though their weight may not change that much, they start to lose muscle mass, they lose bone density. When we're evaluating seniors with obesity, should we be thinking more about disability and frailty than just obesity-related disorders?
So I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because there really needs to be, in my opinion, a movement away from the number and more towards function. We really need to be thinking about physical function in our older adults when they're visiting their primary care or specialty care provider. And that's not to say that we shouldn't be treating or managing chronic conditions by any means. But what are the patient's goals? And this is really all about geriatric care. How do we achieve what's important to the patient? And if it's important to the patient for them to get up and down from a chair and to mitigate the amount of arthritis or pain they have in their knees, well, that's what we should be treating that as a goal. Or is it to get on their floor and to play with their grandchildren? So we need to be thinking about goal-directed therapy in the obesity world and not solely focusing on numbers and comorbidity. That they're both important, but we need to think about physical function. That's really a key to longevity. And evidence shows that individuals who have a diagnosis of frailty or are physically impaired actually do poorly.
And with all patients, I try to emphasize a focus on quality of life and not just the number on the scale. And I think that's particularly important in the elderly patients with obesity.
And there's absolutely robust data to show that, we individuals who focus on diet, focus on exercise, have a good diet quality as well. And that's really important. Thinking about Mediterranean diet is the one that I use, or DASH diet are the two that I usually recommend. These elements actually can reduce the risk of disability. And hence, in whatever remaining time frame one has in their life, that proportion of good time, disability-free time, actually rises.
But patients still want to lose weight. And so when you try to help them lose weight, one of the concerns you have to have about is when you lose weight, you lose both fat and muscle. And they already may have sarcopenia. So how do you manage weight loss in individuals trying to minimize that risk of sarcopenia?
Or weight loss-induced sarcopenia is by far, I would say, an under-recognized and diagnosed clinical entity. Many providers, and there's literature to show this, don't think of sarcopenia. Part of it is because only recently there's an ICD-10 code to bill for sarcopenia, and I'd imagine most folks still aren't even billing for that. But to get to your question, when one loses weight, for every 1 kilogram one loses, 75% is fat, 25% is muscle. So how do you mitigate that loss of muscle mass? And that includes bone mass, so fat-free mass. So bone and muscle mass. It's really all about resistant exercises. So often, in particular, I would say in my early days in training, we were placing patients on diets and saying, you know, start with the diet, then think about the exercise. That's actually not the way to do it, particularly in older adults. If you're going to prescribe a dietary prescription, you need to prescribe an exercise prescription hand in hand. And it's these resistant exercises, the similar ones that are recommended in osteoporosis in older adults, you know, weight-bearing exercises using TheraBands, free weights, you know, machines at a gym. That's what really needs to be done to mitigate loss of muscle mass.
What about protein requirements and protein supplements, or making sure patients get adequate amounts of protein? How much do they need? Is it different for the elderly patient?
Yeah, so protein supplementation is really important, and one's response to a given amount of protein actually diminishes with age. So if I give a younger adult 1 gram of protein per kilogram per day, and I give the same to an older adult, the response to the protein is much less than an older adult. So you need to increase the amount of protein. And it's still debated as to how much, but general consensus suggests about 1.2 grams per kilo per day. Now, the hard part is, how do patients translate that into real world? It's very difficult. And this is where working with specialty providers, registered dietitian, nutritionists can help guide meal plans to that. Protein supplements, otherwise, you know, there's some emerging evidence and some trials that suggest that it may help improve physical function, but we really need larger randomized trials to demonstrate its effectiveness, particularly higher dose protein supplementation in the context of multi-component weight loss interventions.
Does the type of protein matter, a plant-based protein or animal-based protein?
So we tend to try to encourage plant-based for obvious reasons as compared to animal-based proteins. I would say in older adults, the literature is not as robust in the sense that we need more evidence to be able to say that one is better than the other. And if I may, just one more thing, one of the hardest parts is actually getting your patients to actually increase their protein. If you get them to increase their protein, then you can probably talk and determine, you know, which is better for the patient.
Okay. Do elderly patients sometimes have difficulty digesting plant-based proteins?
That's a great question. And certainly, you know, one's digestive tract as one ages does change the absorption, their rates of acid secretion and protein breakdown thereof. So it's hard to say one way or another in terms of the digestion and the absorption, but those are factors. Transit time slows, absorption changes. And that's yet another reason why we recommend increasing the amount of protein as one ages.
So when it comes to different dietary interventions, you can restrict fat, you can restrict carbohydrate, you can limit calorie intake, or even utilize forms of intermittent fasting or time-restricted feeding. Are there any particular dietary interventions that should be avoided in the geriatric population?
And before I answer that, I think which ones should we be recommending, I think is something in thinking about, and I mentioned earlier, Mediterranean diet, DASH diet. And the reason they're well-known entities, proven to work, and actually help comorbidities beyond obesity as well. I'm very hesitant to recommend some of these other diets, so to speak. We really need to be changing the diet quality and understanding what is triggering our patients in consuming certain foodstuffs. And again, a good example, you know, if it's all about caloric intake, one piece of pizza is not the same as one same caloric intake of, say, a bowl of quinoa, for instance. It all has to do with the amount, the type of carbohydrate, the type of fat. We really need to be thinking about those macro and micronutrient concentrations going forward. We need more data. There's a sparse amount of data in an older adult population with regard to some of these other proposed dietary methods to reduce caloric intake and change dietary quality.
And so one of the other things that has increased in availability are options for medications. But my understanding that the clinical trials for those agents don't really include a lot of people in the geriatric age groups. So what are your thoughts about anti-obesity medications for senior patients with obesity?
So, you know, weight loss medications that are currently FDA approved and available on the market really offer a promising potential solution or adjunct to existing behavioral weight loss interventions. Some of the parts is greater than the whole. And we know from the clinical trial evidence in our general population that they work. And the challenge here in older adults is, as you correctly pointed out, is when you look at the data that was provided to the FDA and that led to FDA approval for a number of these medications, 5%, 7% of the population was over the age of 65, and many of the patients are under the age of 75. So you're really dealing with a younger, older adult population. So the data is minimal to be able to recommend. That's not to say that they're not FDA approved, but FDA notes in their must use with caution. There are a number of side effects that these medications place patients at risk for, and hence it's important to have a good collaboration. That's not to say with a primary care doctor. That's not to say that we shouldn't use these medications. That's not what I'm saying. But they need to be used with caution, and they need to be probably used with select patients. And the patients themselves need to be informed of risks, benefits, and the paucity of data.
Now, isn't it true, though, for a lot of medications that we use frequently in the elderly, that there isn't a lot of data in those populations, whether it be statins or even blood pressure medications or a number of other commonly used medications don't necessarily have a lot of data in those that are 70, 75 or above?
And regrettably, older adults are excluded from most clinical trials, particularly medical older adults with medical comorbidity. So patients with multimorbidity, multiple chronic conditions, notoriously excluded from clinical trials. So these are the patients that, you know, primary care doctors are seeing every day. Very rarely would you see an older adult without any chronic medical conditions. So how can you use clinical trial data to guide your practice? You're doing the best guesstimate, so to speak. You raise a really good point. With a lot of the older medications, there are now some trials that have been, you know, the SPRINT trial, and then you have was done in older adults with hypertension. You have some statin trials that are being tested in older adults, related more to cognition now, but otherwise, safety and efficacy of those drugs they've been on the market for years, so they're very well established. And as long as you're aware of the adverse events and ensuring that you're not contributing to further polypharmacy in the older adults, that's something that a primary care doctor is very well versed. With weight loss medications, though, you have side effects of glaucoma, hypertension, constipation. These are things that I see every single day in my practice. So you would hate to aggravate those. But again, as long as you have a good discussion with the patient and they're willing to understand those risks, use with caution.
Well, that's great information. Lastly, when discussing obesity treatment with your patients, what is your favorite bit of advice?
Start low, go slow, keep away and stay away from the number. Focus on function. And you want to make sure, I always try to make sure before I give the pep talk and kind of engage in health promotion within the clinic setting and then link them to community providers, what's their readiness to change? What's their motivation? Often it's after a heart attack, after a major event. They've had a family member who's had a major event. So a lot of it is understanding what are the previous barriers to not engaging in health promotion. I'm using that term deliberately rather than weight loss efforts, because it's really about changing one's diet quality, understanding what behaviorally can be changed and addressed, and then engaging them in both aerobic and resistance-based physical activity programs. And often it should be outside of the medical setting in community-based settings.
Well, that's great. You know, I think it is really important that we stay focused on that quality of life. Very often after a person experiences a sentinel event that triggers their desire to make a lifestyle change, it's because that sentinel event has impacted their quality of life somehow. And you want to keep focused on that, and you want to keep that as a good motivating tool for the individual. You're right, much more so than the number on the scale. Well, thank you for being with us today. And you can learn more about Dr. Batz's presentation through the OMA Academy. His presentation was titled Improving Health and Function in the Older Patient with Obesity. It was a pleasure talking with you today, and I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you very much for your time. It was really a privilege being able to share some insights with you and the audience.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Obesity, a Disease. For more information about Obesity Medicine podcasts and other valuable resources from the clinical leaders in obesity medicine, please visit www.obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode and want to listen regularly, head over to iTunes, where you can subscribe, rate, and leave us a much appreciated review. The views expressed in this episode are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please join us again for our next episode of Obesity, a Disease.